Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Endocrinology. Two experts in diabetes, Dr. Vishwanathan Mohan from India and Dr. Alice Cheng from Canada, respond to questions from the endocrinology and primary care communities. Pre-canvassed questions were gathered from healthcare professionals involved in managing patients with type 2 diabetes. The questions cover practical considerations for the use of basal insulin therapy in patients with type 2 diabetes, with a focus on the current and future use of continuous glucose monitoring, fixed ratio combinations, and once-weekly basal insulin regimens. This activity is supported by an independent medical education grant from Novo Nordisk AS and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Alice Cheng from the Trillium Health Partners and Unity Health Toronto in Canada, and I'm joined by Dr. V. Mohan of Dr. Mohan's Diabetes Specialties Center in Chennai, India. Today, we'll be discussing the role of basal insulin therapy in type 2 diabetes, including the use of continuous glucose monitoring and fixed ratio combinations, and the future use of investigational once-weekly insulins. In this first section, we're going to discuss the topic of why is timely initiation of basal insulin treatment important, and how can the barriers to insulin intensification in type 2 diabetes be overcome? I believe everyone listening to this is fully aware that timely initiation of basal insulin in type 2 diabetes is important to improve long-term clinical outcomes. We fully understand that people living with type 2 diabetes, based on the pathophysiology, will eventually require supplementation, if you will, with insulin therapy in order to help meet glycemic targets. However, there's often a delay in that initiation of the basal insulin, and that chronic hyperglycemia can then lead to microvascular complications, macrovascular complications, as well as impact from a mental health perspective, and ultimately can contribute to an earlier mortality. And it's important to note that once complications occur, be they microvascular or macrovascular, they are often irreversible, even if glycemic control is achieved later on. Despite the importance of achieving glycemic targets in a timely fashion, knowing that insulin therapy is a good tool to achieve that, the actual starting of insulin can often be delayed. One of the important reasons for that potentially is clinical inertia. And clinical inertia is defined as the failure to initiate or intensify therapy according to guidelines, or in this case, when the A1C remains above target. And in fact, a systematic literature review found that clinical inertia was reported in more than 50% of people living with type 2 diabetes in most studies. Now, why is there a delay? It could in fact be due to barriers to daily basal insulin initiation. And those barriers are sometimes barriers for the individual living with diabetes or barriers from us as healthcare providers. So with that in mind, now let's turn to Dr. Mohan so that we can address some of the questions that the audience has submitted on this topic. So the first question from the audience is, I understand that basal insulin should be initiated if glycemic control is not achieved with non-insulin glucose-lowering agents. What criteria do you look for when considering initiating basal insulin? How long do you typically wait before choosing to start the insulin therapy?
Thank you, Dr. Cheng. I think this is a very interesting question. So many years ago, we had only a couple of drugs. We had the sulfonylurea agents, and then there was the biguanides. So if one or both didn't work, the only other option was insulin. Today, the problem is that we have so many classes of drugs, 6 to 8 classes of drugs, that very often patients do not know that when their second or their third drug fails, that by adding one more, they are not going to get much of an improvement. What is becoming increasingly clear is that while the first two drugs may control the diabetes well, addition of the third one, you get only a very marginal improvement. And thereafter, very unlikely that you're going to get any significant lowering of the A1C or better control by adding a third or a fourth or a fifth drug. So there is no strict criteria for starting insulin, and this varies from practice to practice. It varies from patient to patient. But clearly, when you talk about criteria for considering basal insulin, if you are convinced that the oral drugs or the non-insulin glucose-lowering agents, as you put it, are not working, you're not meeting the criteria, then we have to consider basal insulin. Now, how long do we wait? We typically wait for the next visit. And if the patient says, no, no, give me another 2-3 months time and then I'll try hard and I've not been dieting, we probably wait for the next appointment maybe after 2-3 months. And if there's a substantial improvement in the A1C, which is very unlikely, of course, then we may further delay it. So if the criteria are not met with, say, 2 or the maximum 3 oral agents or non-insulin glucose-lowering agents, then we have to consider basal insulin. So we must all attempt to reduce this clinical inertia and to start insulin earlier rather than later if we are to prevent the chronic complications of diabetes.
So let's move on to our next question from the audience. So here it is. I have a 32-year-old moderately active patient who is not achieving glycemic targets on oral antihyperglycemic therapies and dulaglutide. I'm considering adding basal insulin. If I do choose to initiate insulin and she agrees, what should be the starting dose? Can you advise on whether this patient should take their basal insulin in the morning or in the evening?
So talking about the starting dose of insulin, again, there is no fixed formula for starting dose of insulin. I go more by what is the fasting blood glucose level. So if you have very high fasting levels, obviously you can start with a higher dose of the basal insulin. Classically, we start with about 10 to 12 units of insulin because we don't know how sensitive people are, because there's so much of biological variation that the same 10 units of insulin can bring somebody's glucose level shooting down, and for somebody else it may not touch them at all. The next time you see, it'll be the same. So we teach patients self-monitoring of glucose. So we say, why don't you just focus on the fasting glucose level and see how much it has come down? So we always follow the dictum, fix the fasting first. Because we're not even fixed the fasting and you're starting the day with very high elevated glucose level, how are we going to control the postprandial glucose levels or the glucose levels during the day? So whenever we teach our fellows and students, we say, fix the fasting first. So for that, the basal insulin can be used and you can look at the next day and the next day and the next day's fasting level and see how much it has come down. That can very easily help you to adjust the dose of insulin. The question you asked is whether should they take it in the morning or evening. More popular is to take it at night. And I'll tell you the reason why. When somebody has been on oral hypoglycemic agents for a long time, it doesn't affect their lifestyle. Now, if you're telling them, okay, you better start insulin, the first thing they think of is, oh my gosh, I'm a man on the road and I'm going to get hypoglycemia. I have to drive my car and what do I do? They have all kinds of worries. When we tell them that, no, 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 you are going to take it at night, the last thing before you go to bed, have your dinner, then have the shot of insulin, go to bed, your lifestyle is not affected at all. It's long enough to last through the day, but you don't have to worry about this hypoglycemia. Somehow, people are more happy with the basal insulin taken at night. But very often, again, we find that there's no one-size-fits-all in medicine. So when we do the continuous glucose monitoring, we'll find that they're getting the slightly lower glucose levels during the night, but in the daytime, it's all totally out of control. So then we tell them, switch. Let's try the basal insulin in the daytime. And sometimes that works very well.
And it's good to have the options so that it can fit into whatever works best for that individual.
Yes.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for that answer. So the next question. I have a 54-year-old patient with type 2 diabetes and obesity whose glucose levels are above target despite being on the maximum titratable tolerated dose of oral antihyperglycemics and semaglutide. When we've discussed adding basal insulin in the past, they were not ready yet due to worries about the stigma of injecting, fears of it being too complicated and painful, and concerns about weight gain. How do you talk to your patients about their fears and concerns when starting insulin, particularly in the limited time available during a consultation?
Thank you, Dr. Cheng. I think you brought up this point earlier. One of the fears that people have is that this is the last resort. So the first thing to tell them is, first of all, there's no stigma in injecting insulin because insulin is a hormone produced by your body and you're just replacing it. It's like thyroid. If you have a hypothyroidism, you take a thyroid tablet. What stigma is there in taking that? Now, with respect to it being complicated or painful, basal insulin cannot be complicated. That's the simplest thing that you can do. I can understand if you have a basal bolus regime, 4 injections a day, it can be slightly more complicated. Now, the question of painful. Today, with the modern insulins that we have and the very, very fine needles that we have, it's practically painless. In fact, if I can tell you an anecdote, there was somebody who was almost paranoid about insulin injections. So I said, I'm going to give you the injection myself. You said, how do you fit in the time? There are times when we have to personally do it ourselves because when you have such people. So I had already finished the injection and taken out the needle. And this lady was asking me, so when are you going to give me my insulin? And I said, 5 minutes ago is when I gave you the insulin. Now you know that I didn't even tell you I gave it to you. You didn't even feel it. So why are you afraid? And so that kind of makes a big change in people's perception to insulin. So I think once we develop that confidence with the patient and we make our educators available to them, then their fears and concerns are very much reduced. And then they come back later and tell us, Doc, I wish I had agreed to this insulin some time ago. Now, I'm not going to stop this insulin. I like this, they say. So,
yeah, it's not uncommon that someone says, I wish I had started this earlier after they've started it. So, yeah. You're absolutely right.
That's right, yeah.
So for the next question, Dr. Bohan, this is from the audience again. A number of my patients find it difficult to achieve their HbA1c targets using a combination of oral antihyperglycemic agents and basal insulin. What do you suggest is the better approach to further treatment intensification? Is it adding a GLP-1 receptor agonist or is it adding prandial insulin?
There is no one answer. If the audience wants to know, can I just add, because the GLP-1s have also become very popular. So I think it has to be individualized, Dr. Cheng, because let's say somebody's target is not just the A1C, but also has a weight target. Then the GLP-1 RA would be the clear winner because it will help not only in reducing the A1C, but also in bringing down their weight. On the other hand, if weight is not an issue and A1C is the main issue, insulin will trump the GLP-1 RA because there is no limit to the reduction of A1C with insulin. With any other drug, you can get a maximum of 1, if you are very lucky, 2% reduction in A1C. With insulin, there's no such limit. You can reduce 4%, 5%. Insulin is the only hormone, the only anti-diabetic drug with which you can bring down the A1C as much as you like. So if A1C is the main problem, I would first bring it down with insulin, achieve the target, and then if the patient feels that they're putting on weight or something, we can always add the GLP-1 RA. And remember, they're not competition to each other, but a combination of the GLP-1 receptor. I remember when this concept was first introduced, there was a nice article in the journal saying it's a wonderful marriage between GLP-1 receptor analog and insulin because one is working in through a different mechanism. It prevents weight gain and the other, helps to get back your tissues if you have lost and so on. And therefore, giving it in combination is also not a bad idea.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. So on to the next question, again, from the audience. I'm a primary care physician treating many patients with type 2 diabetes. I've heard about basal insulin and a GLP-1 receptor agonist in a single injection, but I'm not clear on what types are available, the differences between them, and the evidence for their use. Can you tell me more about this and how you talk to your patients about these treatments? And are there concerns about potential weight gain? So a timely question, given you just mentioned the combination option.
Yes. So I'm glad I just mentioned that before this question. So there is a lot of real-world data for these fixed-drug combinations, fixed-ratio combinations. All of them have shown significant reduction in A1C, which is not surprising because now using two different mechanisms, one you're using insulin and the other you're using an incretin-based drug. But the reason why this combination has become more popular is because they complement each other so well. So with insulin, one of the problems is weight gain because insulin invariably leads to weight gain. Now, when you use the GLP-1 receptor fixed drug combinations, it's actually associated with weight loss. Retrospective observation studies, retrospective studies, and real-world studies, which have shown that about 1.2 to 2 kilogram weight loss can be there despite combining it with insulin. So we have the IDEG-LIRA, which is a combination of liraglutide and degludec. And then we have the IGLAR-LIXI, which is the glargine and the lixinetide combination. Both have been used, but I'm sure we're going to see many more of these products come in the future. So I think the combination of these have come to stay, and definitely they are having a better effect than any one of these drugs used in isolation.
So thank you very much, Dr. Mohan, for your excellent insights.
Thank you.
I've certainly learned a lot and would agree with a lot of what Dr. Mohan has said. And we've covered over the topics around the importance of timely initiation of basal insulin. We looked at ways to dose basal insulin. We talked a little bit about appropriate titration as well. And very importantly, framing insulin in such a way to reduce some of the barriers or fears that people living with diabetes may have. So we discussed a lot in this particular session, and I want to thank the audience for listening.
Thank you.
In this next section, we're going to be discussing what is the role of continuous glucose monitoring and time in range in optimizing outcomes in patients with type 2 diabetes on basal insulin. So to start, let's set the stage. What exactly is CGM? So CGM uses a subcutaneous sensor to measure interstitial glucose concentrations every few minutes, which then allows the individual living with diabetes as well as their healthcare team to really see exactly what's going on with their blood sugars over the course of a day. Now, this then reveals high and low glucose levels that are not apparent with an HbA1c on its own, because the HbA1c is a high-level look at all of the glucoses, but as a single number, which therefore makes it difficult for us to see the variability that someone may in fact be experiencing. So therefore, CGM really does provide a much more comprehensive assessment of an individual's glucose profile. So with that in mind, let's turn to Dr. Mohan to address some of the questions submitted from our audience on how CGM can help their patients living with type 2 diabetes. So our first question, I understand that CGM is important in people living with type 1 diabetes, but I'm not convinced that it is needed in type 2 diabetes when HbA1c is assessed at routine appointments. In your experience, what are the benefits of using CGM in people living with type 2 diabetes on basal insulin? And do you know of any data to support the use of CGM in such individuals?
Thank you, Dr. Cheng. I think that's a very interesting question. And I think you gave the answer yourself when you said that the A1C only gives you the final result of the glucose levels over the previous 3 months. It doesn't tell you what to do. If you find, I always give the example of a student going for the examination. A student goes for the examination and gets a B grade. And now the parent wants to know, why did the child get a B grade? Now, there's no way you're going to know after the B grade has come. It's only the weekly tests which are done, which will tell you, oh, the child is weak in this or weak in that, or what should be done to improve that score so that the B goes to A. Similarly, when the A1C you get a reading and it tells you that it's completely out of range, all it tells you is that the glucose level has not been good for the last 2 to 3 months. It doesn't tell you anything about what to do. On the other hand, the continuous glucose monitoring shows you exactly what you should do, because this is giving you a tracing of the glucose levels throughout the day. And for people with all forms of diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2, we would like to know a couple of things. Number one, is the glucose level constant throughout the day? Is it between a certain range, what we call as time in range? And we typically say between 70 to 180, if you're using the milligrams per deciliter. And we know that 100% of the time you cannot get time in range, but at least 70% of the time, if you have the time in range, the glucose levels within that range, it's very likely that your A1C will be 7%. Of course, you can also calculate what's called as a GMI, but even from this, you can roughly extrapolate and say that the A1C will be 7%. More importantly, the CGM also tells you whether any low sugar reactions are occurring, hypoglycemia. Now, the A1C won't tell you that. You can have two people with the same A1C of, say, 7%, and you may be happy that you have achieved good control. One person may be getting terrible hypos throughout the night or during the daytime, and that's why the A1C is low, because the hypos are pulling the glucose levels down. This can immediately be detected in CGM. So CGM is generally, most of the trials which have been done have been done in people with type 2 diabetes on insulin. But if you look at what is the data available on CGM in type 2 diabetes, there's a meta-analysis of 13 real-world studies which showed that there was a improvement in the A1C in people who had used CGM compared to those who had not used CGM. Similarly, there have been RCTs which have been done in adults on basal insulin with and without CGM. And in those who had used CGM, there's a significant decrease in the mean HbA1c. There was also an improvement in the time in range. So the topic about CGM use in type 2 diabetes is rapidly evolving. In fact, we have also written an article on that, saying that the CGM can be used in three ways. One, you can use it, say, if you're using a 14-day CGM, the first week can be before you go to the clinic, and then the doctor makes a change in the treatment, and the next 7 days, you can see after the treatment change was made whether there's any improvement. The other way can be that you can use one CGM before the clinic visit and another CGM after the visit to see whether the change in the treatment suggested has had a significant improvement. Of course, a classical way is that the patient walks in and the sugars are high and we're changing a treatment, adding insulin or some change, and a CGM definitely helps to find out better about that.
So now let's move on to the second question from our audience. What is the difference between intermittently scanned CGM and real-time CGM? And how do I choose a monitor that suits my individual patient's needs? What do the guidelines say about CGM use in type 2 diabetes?
The guidelines for use of CGM in type 2 diabetes are evolving, but we already have the American Diabetes Association, the Canadian guidelines, and even the Indian guidelines, the RSSDI guidelines, the Brazilian guidelines. Most of them at present talk about using CGM in those with type 2 diabetes who are on insulin. Some of them just say insulin. For example, the ADA EASD doesn't specify. They say anybody on type 2 diabetes insulin can use it. Diabetes Canada is a little bit more stringent and says those who are on basal bolus insulin, they can use it. Now, regarding the real-time CGM compared to the intermittently scanned CGM, again, it's a question of availability and which country. For example, in India, till last year, we had only the intermittently scanned one. The country did not even have the real-time CGM. So we had no choice. That's not the real use of a CGM, because you're supposed to use it in real time. But it's better than nothing, let me tell you, because it still gives you an idea that perhaps the basal insulin at night could be reduced because a lot of hypos occurring in the nighttime. Patient is not aware about it, and so it still has its uses. We are now pushing that at least 2 or 3 times in a year, if you can use a CGM, it helps to reduce the cost in person with type 2 diabetes. And there are some studies on whether that still turns out to be useful. Of course, the role of the real-time CGM, as suggested in the Diabetes Canada 2021 report, is that if you're on a basal bolus regime, that's pretty much like type 1 because you're already taking 3-4 injections. So there's no doubt that there you would need real-time CGM. So when we're generalizing for different countries, I would say using any CGM is better than not using CGM. Using CGM regularly, if it is possible, affordable, and available, then that is also quite good. So I think there's no one-size-fits-all, but these are evolving guidelines, and very soon we'll probably have better guidelines on where to use it in non-insulin-treated type 2s.
So the next question from the audience, if my patient with type 2 diabetes is using CGM, are there other tools I can use to help with glycemic monitoring? I've read about time and range in the guidelines, but find it quite challenging to understand. How do I apply time and range in clinical practice, and how might it benefit my patients?
So time and range is a relatively new concept, so people might grapple with it for some time. But once you understand it, it's very easy. So what I tell my patients is that the A1C tells you what happened the last 2 to 3 months. Your fasting glucose or your postprandial glucose tells you it's like a snapshot. So if you were taking a picture, whereas a CGM is like a video monitoring. So it's giving you a complete picture throughout the day. And having done that, we would like to know what percentage of the day, if you divide it by number of hours, how much of that time are you actually in a safe limit? It's neither too low nor it is too high. So we always talk about milligrams per deciliter. That's easier for me. So we say below 70, we don't want it to go. And we don't want it to go above 180, which is 10 millimoles per liter. Now, having said that, in life, it always does not work that way. So if it is, say, above 180 or above 10 millimoles per liter, we call it as time above range, or TAR. But if it goes to 250, 300 milligrams, that's not desirable. So we don't want anything in the very high range. Similarly, when you talk about the low sugar range, although it should be 70 ideally, there could be somebody in whom the blood sugar just slipped to 68. Now, that's not a very dangerous situation. But if it goes to the time below range, or the TBR, which is level 2, which is below 3 millimoles per liter or 54 milligram per deciliter, we are worried. And we do, especially if it's an older person and so on. So we don't want them to go. Now, all this is virtually impossible to do if you're even doing self-monitoring of glucose, even if you do it 7 times a day, which means you also have to poke yourself 7 times a day, and that's not cheap either. And after doing that, you can still miss the high point and the low point or the nadir, which you will not miss if you use continuous glucose monitoring. So I think once we put this in front of the patient, once we show the graphs to them, and once they start monitoring themselves, they understand much more about their body and about their glucose than they have ever before. The moment you put the CGM, oh, after dinner, my sugar is going too high, so I'm eating too much carbs there. I'm going to cut my carbs. So it's a nice educational tool as well to teach patients.
So thank you very much, Dr. Mohan, for your fantastic insights. And what we've discussed in this section is looking at the value of continuous glucose monitoring, particularly in type 2 diabetes, and recognizing the value not just for us as healthcare providers, but more importantly, for people living with diabetes so that they can make real-time changes to their behaviors and their choices in order to help achieve glycemic targets. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Chen.
In this final section, we're going to be discussing what is the clinical evidence for once-weekly insulins in type 2 diabetes, and what are the practicalities of their use? So if you think about why do we even need once-weekly insulins, we should consider some of the unmet treatment needs in type 2 diabetes. There are concerns around the number of injections that an individual has to give, wanting more treatment flexibility makes sense, which therefore it's logical that once weekly insulins would be potentially helpful for people living with type 2 diabetes in order to improve treatment adherence by simplifying the regimen such that it's one injection per week, which would then be able to fit into their life better. And with that, one would then hope that that translates into glycemic management, glycemic targets being achieved, and then therefore reductions in complications, including morbidity and perhaps even mortality. So when we're talking about the once weekly basal insulins, the ones that are currently under investigation are insulin Icodec as well as insulin Efsitora alfa. So now let's start by looking at some of the data for insulin Icodec in type 2 diabetes. It was, of course, studied in a large phase 3 clinical trial program called the ONWARDS program. There are data from the insulin naive population as well as the population who is insulin experienced or already on basal insulin. And generally, what has been shown is non-inferiority for A1C reduction with Icodec once weekly compared to an existing daily basal insulin. And in certain cases, like in the insulin naive population, and in one of the studies for the insulin experience, there was also superiority for A1C reduction. When it comes to hypoglycemia, the hypoglycemia rates were generally comparable between insulin Icodec and the comparator daily basal insulins. Given that this is a once weekly basal insulin, what would be interesting is to see could it then be combined with a once weekly GLP-1 receptor agonist, and we can look forward to those data from a study called Combine 3, which is going to compare Icodec semaglutide combination with that of basal bolus insulin. Now, if we move on to discuss insulin Efsitora alfa, which is another weekly basal insulin designed here in type 2 diabetes, there are phase 2 studies that have been completed comparing insulin Efsitora alfa with insulin degludec, generally demonstrating non-inferiority for A1C reduction as well as comparable hypoglycemia rates. So now let's move on to the discussion with Dr. Mohan to address some of the questions from our audience. Here's our first question from the audience. I've heard that once weekly insulins are being developed for use in type 2 diabetes. What sort of patients do you think will be suitable for treatment? And in your opinion, where will once weekly insulins best fit in the treatment algorithm? Do you think they may replace other oral antihyperglycemic or even GLP-1 based therapies?
Thank you, Dr. Cheng. That's a very interesting question. Now, if I can just put it in practical terms, let's say somebody is only on a once daily basal insulin. That's still 365 injections per year. Whereas if you replace that with a once weekly basal insulin, now we're talking about 52 injections, which means 310 injections are gone. And anybody would jump at it. And you've just shown the data that it's not only non-inferior, but in some cases, even superior. Anybody who needs insulin, basal insulin in type 2 diabetes, I think this once weekly would fit the bill. And I'm sure it's going to be hugely popular all over the world. Now, the second part of the question, will it replace other oral hypoglycemic agents or GLP-1 based therapies? I don't think so, because after all, you're using these agents after the oral hypoglycemic agents. So in fact, it can be combined with virtually all the oral hypoglycemic agents. In relation to GLP-1 based therapies, again, it is not a competition to the GLP-1 receptor based therapy, GLP-1 receptor analog, because you can actually combine both of them. You can use them independently. So I don't think they're going to replace the GLP-1 based therapies in that sense. And actually, you showed that combinations of these, the IcoSema, for example, where the Icodec weekly insulin is being combined with a weekly semaglutide. And if that comes, just imagine, we will have both these compounds used only once a week, and definitely it's a dream come true. We discussed earlier in one of the earlier episodes that the addition of the GLP-1 receptor analogs actually helps to prevent weight gain as well.
For the next question from the audience, based on the clinical trial data I've seen, once-weekly insulins have a slightly higher incidence of hypoglycemia compared to daily basal insulin. Should I be worried about the incidence of hypoglycemia if I prescribe a once-weekly insulin? Do you know if the risk and severity of hypos is different for the once-weekly versus daily insulin? How would I need to approach the management of hypoglycemia with weekly compared to daily insulin?
Very good question, and I think this is a logical question. Anybody who has used insulin, or even for HCPs who are considering this, and it's often discussed in our circles. What will happen if somebody has already injected this insulin? They're going to inject a whole week's insulin into one shot. What's going to happen if they get hypoglycemia? Surprisingly, in the trials that we have shown, and you showed the data, the overall incidence of hypoglycemia, if you actually look at it, it could be slightly more with the once weekly insulin. But if you now break it down into the severe hypoglycemia or hypoglycemia needing assistance or any hypoglycemia which needed hospitalization and so on, there was no difference between the once daily insulin and the once weekly insulin. So that's very, very reassuring. Now comes the next question about how do you manage these patients if they have a hypoglycemia. Interestingly enough, again, studies have been done on this, and the management of hypoglycemia is very similar to what you would do with a daily basal insulin. So you measure the amount of, you calculate amount of carbohydrate that you are going to give the person or advise to the person with diabetes, and then they just monitor their response. I think they would do that anyway. The principles of the treatment of the hypoglycemia with a once weekly insulin is exactly the same as one would do with the once daily insulin. It's very interesting. It's amazing that despite giving it once a week, both with the Icodec as well as with the Efsitora alpha, the hypoglycemias have not been disabling or worrying at all.
So definitely reassuring from a clinical perspective. So with the next question, I'm interested in understanding the practicalities of initiating a once-weekly insulin in the clinic. Do you have any advice on switching patients from a daily insulin to a once-weekly insulin, such as timing and dosing and the titration algorithm? Would this be different if the patient was insulin naive when prescribed a once-weekly insulin?
So the question about switching patients from a daily insulin to a once-weekly insulin is quite easy, because the daily insulin, the daily basal insulin, in 24 hours, the action is gone. There's no issue. You just, the very next day, if yesterday they've had the basal insulin, today you can start with the once-weekly insulin. Now, the question is, when you start either in a insulin-naive patient or somebody who has already taken some insulin, are there any guidelines for prescribing this insulin? So when initiating once-weekly basal insulin, for the Icodec insulin and for the insulin Efsitora alpha, there are slightly different guidelines. So if a person with diabetes has never had insulin and is insulin-naive, the usual dose which is prescribed is 70 units as an initial dose. Now, where does this come from? Normally, we talk about 10 units per day as being the starting dose. So into 7, when you multiply that, that comes as a 70 dose. So there's a slight initial loading dose that you give. And then later on, you can titrate it to the dose 2 and dose 3, you can titrate it. When the somebody has been using a prior basal insulin, it has been worked out that you multiply the daily dose that the person is using by 10.5 and use that as a loading dose. And for the subsequent doses, you multiply it by 7, the daily dose. For there is a similar algorithm worked out for the insulin Efsitora alpha also, where there is a slight loading dose, and then subsequently for dose 1 and dose 2, you adjust the dose accordingly.
So thank you for that. So now let's move on to our next question from the audience. I'm curious about how once weekly insulin could be used for those patients who can be difficult to manage using daily basal insulin. Do you predict challenges in managing, for example, those who exercise frequently or who are unwell or hospitalized, considering the dose can only be titrated once a week? The mean age of those included in the clinical trials was around 60. So do you think that once weekly insulins will be suitable for those who are older, let's say over the age of 75?
So my short answer to the first one or two questions is that if somebody has a lifestyle issue which is changing all the time, for example, one day they are exercising more and the weekends they exercise less or more or whatever, if they wish to continue with the daily insulin, so be it. If they are happier with it, then that's fine as well. However, since we mentioned that there are not too many issues related to hypoglycemia with these weekly insulins, so I don't see it as a major challenge that because you're doing some exercise, you should not take weekly insulin. I'm sure this will be adapted by the person, especially when you have continuous glucose monitoring to help you. Now, I would imagine that for an acute situation, suppose somebody is admitted in hospital and needs frequent changes of insulin, that person is more likely to be on a basal bolus insulin, which needs frequent changes of insulin. Obviously, that's not the situation to use a weekly insulin because you need more changes. So I think the introduction of the weekly insulin, in my opinion, is a great thing for people to reduce the burden of insulin injections. It will help many more people to remove the stigma of insulin or the fear of insulin, and many more people can go on to insulins. As far as the question about 60 years and 75 years is concerned, but I don't see, a big difference because we are not talking about somebody who is at very high risk if you take this insulin or getting more hypoglycemia. If anything, for an older person, taking it once a week is better than taking it every day, isn't it? So I would think that should not be a challenge at all in using once weekly insulin.
I want to thank you, Dr. Mohan, for all of your incredible insights. And I think today we've covered a lot of information in the three sessions that we have discussed. In the beginning, we talked about basal insulin therapy and type 2 diabetes, how to start it, how not to delay it. Then we discussed the use of continuous glucose monitoring. And then finally, we looked to the future into some investigational products, which include the once weekly basal insulins and their use in type 2 diabetes. So again, on behalf of the audience, I'd like to thank Dr. Mohan for his valuable insights, and I'd like to thank you, the audience, for watching.
Thank you to both our faculty, and thank you to our audience for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on type 2 diabetes and related topics at www.touchendocrinology.com.